Chapter 14. Nothing but pride loves to be flattered, and that only as it is a vice which blinds us to our own imperfections. I think princes as particularly unhappy in having their good actions magnified as their evil actions covered. But King William, who has already won praise by the steps of dangerous virtue, seems reserved for some actions which are above the touch of flattery, whose praise is in themselves. And such would this be. And because I am speaking of a work which seems to be proper only for the hand of the king himself, I shall not presume to carry on this chapter to the model, as I have done in other subjects. Only thus far. That a society be erected by the king himself, if his majesty thought fit, and composed of none, but persons of the first figure in learning, and it were to be wished our gentry were so much lovers of learning, that birth might always be joined with capacity. The work of this society should be, to encourage polite learning, to polish and refine the English tongue, and advance the, so much neglected faculty of correct language, to establish purity and propriety of style, and to purge it from all the irregular additions, that ignorance and affectation have introduced. And all those innovations in speech, if I may call them such, which some dogmatic writers have the confidence to foster upon their native language, as if their authority were sufficient to make their own fancy legitimate. By such a society I dare say the true glory of our English style would appear, and among all the learned part of the world be esteemed, as it really is, the noblest and most comprehensive of all the vulgar languages in the world. Into this society should be admitted none, but persons eminent for learning, and yet none, or but very few, whose business or trade was learning. For I may be allowed, I suppose, to say we have seen many great scholars, mere learned men, and graduates in the last degree of study, whose English has been far from polite, full of stiffness and affectation, hard words, and long unusual coupling of syllables and sentences, which sound harsh and untunable to the ear, and shock the reader both in expression and understanding. In short, there should be room in this society for neither clergyman, physician, nor lawyer. Not that I would put an affront upon the learning of any of those honorable employments, much less upon their persons. But if I do think that their several professions do naturally and severally prescribe habits of speech to them peculiar to their practice, and prejudicial to the study I speak of, I believe I do them no wrong. Nor do I deny, but there may be, and now are, among some of all those professions men of style and language, great masters of English, whom few men will undertake to correct. And where such do at any time appear, their extraordinary merit should find them a place in this society, but it should be rare, and upon very extraordinary occasions, that such be admitted. I would therefore have this society wholly composed of gentlemen, whereof 12 to be of the nobility, if possible, and 12 private gentlemen, and a class of 12, to be left open for mere merit, let it be found in who or what sort it would, which should lie as the crown of their study, who have done something eminent to deserve it. The voice of this society should be sufficient authority for the usage of words, and sufficient also to expose the innovations of other men's fancies. They should preside with a sort of judicature over the learning of the age, and have liberty to correct and censure the exorbitance of writers, especially of translators. The reputation of this society would be enough to make them the allowed judges of style and language, and no author would have the impudence to coin without their authority. Custom, which is now our best authority for words, would always have its original here, and not be allowed without it. There should be no more occasion to search for derivations and constructions, and 'twould be as criminal then to coin words as money. The exercises of this society would be lectures on the English tongue, essays on the nature, original, usage, authorities, and differences of words, or the propriety, parity, and cadence of style, and of the politeness and manner in writing, reflections upon irregular usages, and corrections of erroneous customs in words, And, in short, everything that would appear necessary to the bringing our English tongue to a due perfection, and our gentlemen to a capacity of writing like themselves, to banish pride and pedantry, and silence the impudence and impertinence of young authors, whose ambition is to be known, though it be by their folly. I ask leave here for a thought or two about that inundation custom has made upon our language and discourse by familiar swearing. And I place it here, because custom has so far prevailed in this foolish vice, that a man's discourse is hardly agreeable without it, and some have taken upon them to say it is pity it should not be lawful, it is such a grace in a man's speech, and adds so much vigor to his language. I desire to be understood right, and that by swearing I mean all those cursory oaths, curses, execrations, imprecations, asseverations, and by whatsoever other names they are distinguished, which are used in vehemence of discourse, in the mouths almost of all men more or less, of what sort soever. I am not about to argue anything of their being sinful and unlawful, as forbid by divine rules. Let the parson alone to tell you that, who has, no question, said as much to as little purpose in this case as in any other. But I am of the opinion, that there is nothing so impertinent, so insignificant, so senseless, and foolish as our vulgar way of discourse, when mixed with oaths and curses, and I would only recommend a little consideration to our gentlemen, who have sense and wit enough, and would be ashamed to speak nonsense in other things, but value themselves upon their parts. I would but ask them to put into writing the commonplaces of their discourse, and read them over again, and examine the English, the cadence, the grammar of them, then let them turn them into Latin, or translate them into any other language, and but see what a jargon and confusion of speech they make together. Swearing, that lewdness of the tongue, that scum and excrement of the mouth, is of all vices the most foolish and senseless. It makes a man's conversation unpleasant, his discourse fruitless, and his language nonsense. It makes conversation unpleasant, at least to those who do not use the same foolish way of discourse, and, indeed, is an affront to all the company who swear not as he does. For if I swear, and curse in company, I either presume all the company likes it, or affront them who do not. Then it is fruitless. For no man is believed a jot the more for all the asseverations, damnings, and swearings he makes. Those who are used to it themselves do not believe a man the more, because they know they are so customary, that they signify little to bind a man's intention, and they who practice them not have so mean an opinion of those that do as makes them think they deserve no belief. Then, they are the spoilers and destroyers of a man's discourse, and turn it into perfect nonsense. And to make it out I must descend a little to particulars, and desire the reader a little to foul his mouth with the brutish, sordid, senseless expressions which some gentlemen call polite English, and speaking with a grace. Some part of them indeed, though they are foolish enough, as effects of a mad, inconsiderate rage, are yet English, as when a man swears he will do this, or that, and it may be adds, God damn him he will, that is, God damn him if he don't. This, though it be horrid in another sense, yet may be read in writing, and is English. But what language is this? Jack, God damn me, Jack, how dost do? How hast thou done this long time, by God? And then they kiss, and the other, as lewd as himself, goes on. Dear Tom, I am glad to see thee with all my heart, let me die. Come, let us go take a bottle, we must not part so, prithee let's go, and be drunk by God. This is some of our new florid language, and the graces and delicacies of style, which if it were put into Latin, I would fain know which is the principal verb. But for a little further remembrance of this impertinence, go among the gamesters, and there nothing is more frequent than, God damn the dice, or God damn the bulls. Among the sportsmen it is, God damn the hounds, when they are at a fault, or, God damn the horse, if he balks a leap. they call men sons of and dogs, and innumerable instances may be given of the like gallantry of language, grown now so much a custom. It is true, custom is allowed to be our best authority for words, and it is fit it should be so, but reason must be the judge of sense in language, and custom can never prevail over it. Words, indeed, like ceremonies in religion, may be submitted to the magistrate, but sense, like the essentials, is positive, unalterable, and cannot be submitted to any jurisdiction. It is a law to itself. It is ever the same. Even an act of parliament cannot alter it. Words, and even usages in style, may be altered by custom, and proprieties in speech differ according to the several dialects of the country, and according to the different manner in which several languages do severally express themselves. But there is a direct signification of words, or a cadence in expression, which we call speaking sense. This, like truth, is sullen and the same, ever was and will be so, in what manner, and in what language soever it is expressed. Words without it are only noise, which any brute can make as well as we, and birds much better, for words without sense make but dull music. Thus a man may speak in words, but perfectly unintelligible as to meaning, he may talk a great deal, but say nothing. But it is the proper position of words, adapted to their significations, which makes them intelligible, and conveys the meaning of the speaker to the understanding of the hearer, the contrary to which we call nonsense. And there is a superfluous crowding in of insignificant words, more than are needful, to express the thing intended, and this is impertinence, and that again, carried to an extreme, is ridiculous. Thus when our discourse is interlined with needless oaths, curses, and long parentheses of imprecations, and with some of very indirect signification, they become very impertinent, and these being run to the extravagant degree instanced in before, become perfectly ridiculous and nonsense, and without forming it into an argument, it appears to be nonsense by the contradictoriness. And it appears impertinent by the insignificancy of the expression. After all, how little it becomes a gentleman to debauch his mouth with foul language, I refer to themselves in a few particulars. This vicious custom has prevailed upon good manners too far, but yet there are some degrees to which it has not yet arrived. As, first, the worst slaves to this folly will neither teach it to, nor approve of it in their children. Some of the most careless will indeed negatively teach it by not reproving them for it, but sure no man ever ordered his children to be taught to curse or swear. 2. The grace of swearing has not obtained to be a mode yet among the women. God damn me does not fit well upon a female tongue. It seems to be a masculine vice, which the women are not arrived to yet. And I would only desire those gentlemen who practice it themselves to hear a woman swear. It has no music at all there, I am sure, and just as little does it become any gentleman, if he would suffer himself to be judged by all the laws of sense, or good manners in the world. It is a senseless, foolish, ridiculous practice. It is a mean to no manner of end. It is words spoken which signify nothing. It is folly acted for the sake of folly, which is a thing even the devil himself don't practice. The devil does evil, we say, but it is for some design, either to seduce others, or, as some divines say, from a principle of enmity to his maker. Men steal for gain, and murder to gratify their avarice or revenge. Whoredoms and ravishments, adulteries and sodomy, are committed to please a vicious appetite, and have always alluring objects, and generally all vices have some previous cause, and some visible tendency. But this, of all vicious practices, seems the most nonsensical and ridiculous. There is neither pleasure nor profit, no design pursued, no lust gratified, but is a mere frenzy of the tongue, a vomit of the brain, which works by putting a contrary upon the course of nature. Again, other vices men find some reason or other to give for, or excuses to palliate. Men plead want to extenuate theft, and strong provocations to excuse murders, and many a lame excuse they will bring for whoring, but this sordid habit even those that practice it will own to be a crime, and make no excuse for it, and the most I could ever hear a man say for it was that he could not help it. Besides, as it is an inexcusable impertinence, so it is a breach upon good manners and conversation, for a man to impose the clamor of his oaths upon the company he converses with. If there be any one person in the company that does not approve the way, it is an imposing upon him with a freedom beyond civility. To suppress this, laws, acts of parliament, and proclamations are baubles and banters, the laughter of the lewd party, and never had, as I could perceive, any influence upon the practice, nor are any of our magistrates fond, or forward of putting them in execution. It must be example, not penalties, must sink this crime. And if the gentlemen of England would once drop it as a mode, the vice is so foolish, and ridiculous in itself, it would soon grow odious, and out of fashion. This work such an academy might begin, and I believe nothing would so soon explode the practice as the public discouragement of it by such a society, where all our customs and habits, both in speech and behavior, should receive an authority. All the disputes about precedency of wit, with the manners, customs, and usages of the theater, would be decided here. Plays should pass here, before they were acted, and the critics might give their censures and damn at their pleasure. Nothing would ever die which once received life at this original. The two theaters might end their jangle, and dispute for priority no more. Wit and real worth should decide the controversy, and here should be the infallible judge. The strife would then be only to do well, and he alone be crowned who did excel. He called them Whigs, who from the church withdrew, but now we have our stage dissenters too, who scruple ceremonies of pit and box, and very few are sound and orthodox, but love disorder so, and are so nice, they hate conformity, though 'tis in vice. Some are for patent hierarchy, and some, like the old Gauls, seek out for elbow room. Their arbitrary governors disown, and build a conventicle stage of their own. Fanatic foe make up the gaudy show, and wit alone appears incognito. Wit and religion suffer equal fate, neglect of both attends the warm debate. For while the parties strive and countermine, wit will as well as piety decline. Next to this, which I esteem as the most noble and most useful proposal in this book, I proceed to academies for military studies, and because I design rather to express my meaning than make a large book, I bring them all into one chapter. I allow the war is the best academy in the world, where men study by necessity and practice by force, and both to some purpose, with duty. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.